Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of the mindrenewed.com, podcasting to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And it's good to be back after our break that had to be extended, which meant of course that interview with Vince McCann of Spotlight Ministries had to be postponed. I do apologise for that. Things have been just really very busy getting back to everything after Easter. But we're back on track now, I hope. And of course, today we have this interview with Dr. Frank Legg on the whole debate as to what it was that hit the Pentagon on 9/11. Was it really a Boeing 757? Or perhaps was it something else, a missile? Or did that aircraft fly over the top and it was some bombs that caused the damage there that day? Well, after looking at this from a scientific point of view for some time, although he disagrees with the overall official 9/11 narrative and very much believes that 9/11 was an inside job, he has come to the opinion that it was, in fact, a 757 that hit that day and very probably American Airlines Flight 77. And I think you'll find it very interesting listening to the reasons that he gives for that and also the implications that he draws out for the whole question of 9/11 truth. Next week, we hope to be speaking with Russ Wise, who's an expert in new religious movements and staff member of Christian Information Ministries, who will be speaking to us about the highly influential A Course in Miracles. And in the week that follows, we expect to be joined by Patrick Wood, editor of the August Forecast and the August Review, who was a co-author with Professor Anthony Sutton back in the 1970s of the two-volume Trilaterals Over Washington, who will be joining us to discuss that organization, the Trilateral Commission, and very interestingly for us here on this program, the connections between the Trilateral Commission and technocracy and Agenda 21. In the week that follows, we hope to be speaking to Eric Stacey, the long-established screenwriter, producer, director, and editor, on the making of his newest movie that's only recently come out, Unthinkable, an airline captain's story, which if you haven't seen that, I do highly recommend that you go to Vimeo and have a look at that. It's a gripping movie just in its own right, from the point of view of being a thriller, but it's based upon events surrounding the very mysterious deaths of Philip Marshall, the retired airline captain and 9/11 researcher, at the beginning of last year. His two teenage children and he himself were found dead in February 2013, and the county sheriff came to the conclusion that Marshall had murdered his children and then killed himself in a tragic murder-suicide. But the journalist Wayne Madsen investigated the situation and came to the conclusion that they had been victims of professional killers, and the movie is a dramatization based upon, in large part, on Madsen's research. May I say thanks to Pixie for responding to the request for transcripts, who's been working on a couple of the Dr. Paul Craig Roberts interviews for us. And I'm very grateful to you for doing that. But let me also say that please, if there's anybody else who would like to, is in a position to and would like to produce a transcript or two of some of the interviews that we've had on the podcast, perhaps a favorite interview, as I said before, I know time is precious, but it will be great to get some more of these transcripts up. So if you have the time to do that, please let me know. That would be absolutely fantastic. Also, thanks again for all the encouraging messages that have come through email and increasingly through Facebook these days. It's very much appreciated. I do very much enjoy the interaction with people in that way. So without further ado, we move now to the interview with Dr. Frank Legg. Hello, everybody. Julian Charles here of the mindrenewed.com, podcasting to you, as usual, from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Today is the 1st of May 2014, and I'm very pleased to be able to welcome to the programme, speaking to us from Australia, Dr. Frank Legg, who is a long-standing researcher into the events of 9/11 and a critic of the official story. He holds a PhD in chemistry, which of course inclines him towards questions of a scientific nature about what happened that day, and he is a frequent contributor to the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which of course is co-edited by Kevin Ryan, who was a guest on this program just a few weeks ago. Dr. Legg, thank you very much indeed for agreeing to speak with us on The Mind Renewed.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
It's such a shame that we have a poor line here. We have a lot of hiss on the line, but I'm sure that our conversation will be so interesting that that won't be a problem as we proceed. Now, I came across your work shortly after interviewing Kevin Ryan, and when I was looking at the Journal of 9/11 Studies, I noticed that you had several papers published there, and there was one that caught my attention in particular, and that was a paper that you published in 2009 called What Hit the Pentagon? Misinformation and its effect on the credibility of 9/11 truth. And in that paper, you respond to claims by many people within the 9/11 truth movement that the damage to the Pentagon was not actually caused by a Boeing 757 that day, but rather there's some other kind of explanation for that. And through your scientific analysis, you come to the conclusion that that view is mistaken, that it very probably was American Airlines Flight 77. But you also make a more general point that, in your view, too many people have become fixated on particular theories about what happened that day, and that this is an unhealthy state of affairs for the cause of 9/11 truth. So I'd like to get into all of that with you as we proceed. But let me start by asking you to introduce yourself to us a little bit more, and perhaps you could give us some idea as to how you got into this whole business of questioning the official story of 9/11.
Well, like a lot of other people who have become ardent activists for 9/11 truth, for many years I accepted the official story without really questioning it. I eventually became aware that people were disputing the official story, and I still didn't take much notice until eventually it caught my eye that people were saying that the buildings at the World Trade Center had come down too fast. And it immediately struck me that this was something I could check myself. I didn't have to depend on anybody else for the information. Mm-hmm. So the videos are there, and there is software you can download on the internet that enables you to view the videos frame by frame. So I did that. I showed that the Building 7 came down exactly at 3:04, as near as I could measure, and that the two towers came down at about 2/3 3:04 speed, but all three of them came down in a most extraordinary way. They all came down with constant acceleration. Particularly in the case of Building 7, where the acceleration was exactly at 3:04, the symmetry of the collapse was extraordinary. How can a building which is being heated to the point of collapse suddenly have all its support simultaneously removed? The answer is it's impossible. Therefore, explosives must be involved. And once I realised that, I've been studying the question ever since.
And did you find convincing the NIST report that I believe was finalized in 2008 that at least claimed to have explained how that could have happened?
No, their final explanation is just as absurd as their original one. The original explanation from NIST was that the building was experiencing very severe fire on the south side, which we can't see in the videos. But they must have eventually realised that that was an absurd explanation, because if that had been the case, while the north side wasn't even remotely hot, the building would have to lean toward the south, and it didn't. So I think they took 7 years before they managed to think up a halfway plausible idea, and they thought of this idea of expansion causing part of the structure to move off a support bracket and drop, and as it dropped, it fell onto the floor below and destroyed that floor and so on, until sufficient of this particular column was exposed to enable it to buckle. But that is an absurd explanation also for a number of reasons, and I think probably the most obvious reason for that is that if you were getting a collapse of that nature, it would be progressive. That column would buckle. The buckling of that column would lead to the floors attached to it being pulled sideways, and that would spread the collapse across the face of the building. But all those floors are connected to the outside wall. Therefore, if that was happening, you would see the outside wall buckling, but you don't. The outside wall remains a perfect plane and falls all of a sudden with the whole building. It just is not possible without explosives.
And you have similar concerns about the Twin Towers as well. Could you explain briefly why you feel those are implausible in the way that it's normally described as happening?
Well, it's the same as Building 7, except that the towers came down a bit slower. David Chandler has done a lot of excellent work on the towers. He shows that if the towers are coming down at a uniform acceleration somewhat less than 3:04, it implies that there is an upward force on the towers, which is uniform, and it's about 1/3 of the force required to hold up the top of the tower. Now, the tower was designed to be about three times stronger than it needed to be, three or four, maybe even five times stronger than it needed to be. So if the top of the tower is experiencing only an upward force of a third of its weight, it means that the columns had been reduced somehow to about a tenth of their original design strength. Now, there's no way that could happen without explosives. So, you know, it's the same argument. Even though it isn't free fall, the argument is absolutely convincing. And, of course, there's the symmetry, the beautifully symmetrical falls, especially the North Tower, and the totality of the fall. We can see puffs of dust coming out ahead of the collapse. Just so many things once you look into it. The only explanation is controlled demolition. And, of course, there's other things too. You know, we find the debris in the dust, the debris of molten iron. We find traces of nanothermite, which we can now conclude is the source of the little spheres of iron which were found in the dust. So we not only know that towers came down by explosives, but we even know what the explosive was, or at least one of the explosives used, nanothermite. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was very privileged actually to have Dr. Niels Harrit on in the early days of this podcast to give us the account of what he and his team had discovered with that, and it was very, very interesting indeed.
It's totally convincing.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we get into the detail of your arguments about Flight 77, I'd like you to say something about what you describe as the... Well, you speak of it as a kind of dogmatism within the 9/11 truth movement, where some people seem to be wedded to particular theories, almost as if there is a reluctance to engage with scientific reasoning in some ways. At least that's what you seem to suggest in your pieces. So why do you think, if that is the case, why do you think that is so unfortunate for the movement? Do you think there's even a trap there for the movement?
Well, let's deal with why it's unfortunate for a start. Imagine that you're a member of the public and you're listening to an activist talking at the side of the road, and he's trying to explain to you that 9/11 was an inside job, and he's talking about the towers coming down with explosives, and then he also says that the plane didn't hit the Pentagon, it flew over the top. You know, the person in the street is going to say, that's pretty ridiculous. Lots of people saw the building being hit by an aeroplane. There are a lot of people around. None of them reported seeing the plane fly over the top. Therefore, the idea that the plane didn't hit is patently absurd. And so the public is going to say, if the activists get the Pentagon wrong, they've probably got the story about controlled demolition wrong. And I think that would set back the progress of the truth by decades. You know, we'd all be dead, be like JFK, go down in history and be lost and the chances missed. And I think it's quite reasonable to suggest that the authorities have realised that arguing about the Pentagon is very beneficial to them. It keeps everybody distracted. And if they feel that they're going to be prosecuted, if ever they feel that the public is so incensed by the information that they're starting prosecution, all they need to do is reveal the truth. AA-77 did hit the Pentagon. People say, oh, well, you know, it's all rubbish and forget about it. So it's a terrible threat.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree with David Ray Griffin where he says that really we should concentrate on the points where we are agreed within the 9/11 truth movement and put issues such as what hit the Pentagon into very much a secondary position? Do you agree with that approach?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We should all be talking about the controlled demolition. Nobody should raise a question of the Pentagon. If you're talking to the public, it should be all about the things we know for certain. And I'm quite certain that the plane did hit the Pentagon, but a lot of activists are not certain, and therefore they confuse the public, and that's very, very damaging. Mm-hmm. And I agree with David Ray Griffin that we should be focusing our attention on the collapse of the towers, but also I do think there's a bit of a need for some scientists to get together and say, look, you really have to look at the evidence about the Pentagon and clarify this. Now, I disagree with David Ray Griffin about the best way to deal with the problem. He seems to think it's insoluble, and therefore you shouldn't talk about it. But I think it is soluble. I've looked at the evidence. I think it's absolutely very, very convincing that a plane did hit the Pentagon, and we should just stick with that and get together on it so that we get the numbers up. At the moment, a lot of scientists are reluctant to get involved. I noticed that there was this reluctance, and it went on for a long time, and I eventually thought, well, I've got nothing to lose. I'm not employed by a university. I'll stick my neck out and I'll start talking about the Pentagon, and I will demonstrate that the evidence strongly supports the opinion that a large passenger plane hit the Pentagon, and I'll try and clear up the confusion in that way. Well, I haven't succeeded totally. I've convinced a lot of people, but there are still a rather substantial number of activists who disagree with me.
And have you had a lot of opposition in a sort of in a rather negative way? Because, I mean, you, in one of your pieces, you say that people are critical of your method and say that you're not actually engaging in a properly scientific enterprise. Do you want to say something about that?
Regarding the Pentagon?
Yeah.
Well, I think what I do is scientific. My hypothesis is that a large plane hit the Pentagon. Now, there are so many people who say they saw it hit. There are so many people who said they saw the plane approach, and even if they didn't see it hit, they said it was low. There's really no reason to think the plane did not hit. The only reason why some people have got onto this idea that the plane didn't hit is because there have been a few rather strange people who decided for one reason or another that they were going to suggest various other things. Some people suggested that it was damaged by a missile. Nobody saw a missile. Lots of people saw a plane. Some people say that the plane approached at an angle which could not have hit the light poles and could not have done the observed damage. And if it did hit at that angle, it would have done damage in a different direction. Therefore, the only explanation they say is that the plane flew over the top. But the problem with that theory is that there were hundreds of people around the Pentagon at the time. There were roads right around the Pentagon, all sides. Lots of the traffic was in traffic jams. So there were hundreds of people just sitting there, able to see the roof of the Pentagon. And how could it be that if a plane flew over the top, not one person has reported it?
Well, that's correct, is it? Not one person has actually said that it flew over the top of the Pentagon.
Not one person. Mm-hmm. Now, when you start looking at the way the conversation about the Pentagon goes, you realise that some of the deception is created by the way the questions are asked. People ask the question, which way did the plane approach the Pentagon? Was it on the south side of the naval annex, or was it on the north side? Was it on the north side of the Sitka service station? Now, that's a question of angle of approach. Why would anybody remember that clearly when they just saw the plane hit the Pentagon, the most astonishing thing? They wouldn't think, people are going to ask me which way the plane approached in years to come. I better take note of that. They're just going to have their minds full of the fact that they've seen the plane hit the Pentagon.
But what is the significance of that anyway? I mean, if it flew in one direction or flew in another direction, we're still talking about a plane.
Yes. The thing is that the plane did damage through the light poles and also did damage through all the columns inside the Pentagon, and finally damaged the wall of the C-rings, the third ring in. And all those damages are in a beautiful straight line. And that straight line is in the same direction as the FDR data. It's in the same direction as the radar data. So if the plane came in at a different angle, it would have caused different damage. It would have damaged different columns inside the Pentagon. But it didn't. So people say because those columns weren't damaged in the direction of the north path, let's point out that people talk about the north path and the south path. If a plane came in on the north path, it would have done damage in a different direction, and it didn't do that damage, therefore it must have flown over the top. That's the only justification for the idea that the plane flew over the top. There's no other justification. And there is plenty of witnesses to the plane coming on the south path.
So we would need to see that the pattern of damage that is claimed to be for the south path is dubious in some way in order to cast doubt on that.
Yes, you would, but it isn't. Everything is in accord. All the aspects of it are in accord with one another. whereas the idea that the plane flew over the top is an extraordinary idea, and it would require extraordinary evidence to prove it. But there is no such evidence.
Okay, can we turn then to some of the detail of your evidence? And I wanted to ask you about some of the iconic images, if you like, from the whole controversy over the Pentagon. And I think the one that's got to be at the top of the list is that image of the hole at the front of the Pentagon, where it's claimed by many that, based on this photograph, that the hole in the West Wing is just not big enough to have been caused by a Boeing 757. So is that right?
Yeah, that's right. The hole is about 16 feet wide, and the fuselage of the plane is about 13 feet wide. It's quite wide enough for the top of the fuselage. But the point is, that's not the whole of the damage. That's just the damage on the second floor. At the ground floor level, the damage, the Pentagon face is marked in the shape of a Boeing 757, and that shape reaches for the full width of the Boeing 757. It even shows the dihedral angle of the wings. You know, if people weren't saying the plane flew over the top, everybody would just say, of course the plane hit the Pentagon, you can see where it hit.
But the actual hole that penetrates into the facade of the Pentagon isn't big enough, is it?
Well, that's only at the second floor. The hole on the ground floor is clear for 90 feet, and 90 feet is more than wide enough to admit all the heavy parts of the airplane, the engines, the keel. And actually, the hole goes further than that. The hole on the ground floor is about 140 feet wide, but it does have a bit of debris in it. But it's 90 feet clear, and that 90 feet is more than wide enough to allow both the engines. Now, see, don't forget that the heavy parts of the plane are extraordinarily heavy compared to the wingtips. The wingtips are just little bits of aluminium, nothing much in them at all. You don't expect them to actually go through the wall. In the case of the North Tower, we've got a beautiful image of the wingtips of the plane impacting the aluminium. But there's no aluminium on the Pentagon, so the images are not clear in that way. But they're clear enough, and the damage on the Pentagon does match a 757.
Yeah, I must admit there is one photograph that I think it might be in one of Jim Hoffman's analyses where he shows, if you're looking further to the left where the wingtip presumably hit the front, you can see that it's taken off the front layer of the facade, but presumably the wingtip at that point would have been destroyed and thrown outward. Would it have been thrown inward or thrown outward onto the lawn, do you think?
I don't think either of those things would be true. I think it would be shattered into tiny fragments. Now, we have the experiment done with a jet plane on a skid on a railway track running into a concrete block. Have you heard about that?
Yes.
The Phantom, A4 Phantom experiment. Now, that plane just turned into confetti when it hit the concrete block. So any bit of aluminium that can't penetrate will just turn into confetti at that speed. However, the Pentagon wall wasn't a concrete block. It was capable of being broken and turned into a great big hole. So you don't expect the whole thing to be turned into confetti, only the wingtips. Most of the plane went inside.
Yeah, that does seem very convincing, actually, looking at that particular photograph and then seeing quite a lot of small fragments outside.
Yeah, there's quite a substantial amount of small fragments outside, and there's a huge amount of large fragments inside. And I have received emails from people who are working in the Pentagon after the impact. I got one bloke who was detailed to look through the rubbish to find bodies, and he said while he was working there, the thought never crossed his mind that it wasn't an aeroplane that he was searching through. Never crossed his mind. So, you know, so many people can tell us that this plane did go in there between the ground floor and the first floor, most of it. You know, this same bloke says it took about 8 people to pick up the engine that they came across and carry it outside. So, you know, there's all this information that people just don't seem to have bothered to look for. It's there.
Yeah, we're going to return to some of that in a few minutes, actually. I wanted to ask you about the very famous video release. There's been a subsequent one since, and people have doubts about these because in that initial Pentagon video release, it shows a few frames of footage from the outside CCTV camera, one of them, which apparently shows something fast approaching the building. It doesn't look much like an aircraft. There seems to be a trail of white smoke with a very indistinct image of something in front of that, which many say is just too small to be the kind of aircraft that we're talking about. So what's your view of that video release and the subsequent one as well?
Well, I just pay attention to what I call the hard evidence. I don't regard that video as hard evidence. It's very soft. It's very easy to manipulate an image these days. And it's very unclear. Whatever it was a long way away from the camera. I think you can't put any weight into that image at all, really. About the only thing that I find interesting about that image is that I think there are two cameras that have been recorded. One of them shows a piece of debris flying over the roof of the Pentagon, and two or three small pieces actually land on the ground just in front of the camera, and they bounce across the road. I think that gives an indication that something pretty dramatic happened at the Pentagon at that moment. And some people suggest that explosives were used at the Pentagon to increase the effect. I can find no reason to dispute that. It may very well be the case that explosives were set off at the same time as the plane hit. But that has got no bearing on the question of whether the Pentagon was hit by a plane. It was. The fact that explosives may have been used does not prove that a plane was not there.
But David Ray Griffin says that there is something significant about this video release in that there must have been many, many more images of whatever happened there at the time. And if, in fact, it was a Boeing 757 that hit, then it would have been in the interests of the authorities to release those videos at the time so that everybody could see that. And the very fact they haven't done that is heavily suggestive that they don't have that evidence because it wasn't that hit.
Well, there are two things to say about that. The first is, how can he be sure that there are any video images that show the plane hitting? These cameras, some of them are set to take a photo every 30 seconds or something like that. The plane could pass all the way in through the range of vision without actually being spotted on the way in. And which direction are the cameras going to be facing? I mean, most of the cameras are going to be facing outwards around the building. They're not going to be facing at the impact point. I think it's highly unlikely that there were... Well, there's no proof that there is another video which would have shown it more clearly. There's no proof. And the other thing to say about it is that if you've got evidence which is confusing, which all this is, like the video evidence is confusing, and we've got confusion coming from people who say the plane flew over the top. Now, I think it didn't take the authorities very long to realise that this confusion was working to their advantage. It meant that the activists are arguing against one another and destroying their credibility regarding the Twin Towers. So I think it's really very important that we get this thing about the Pentagon straight. And as I think I mentioned earlier in this talk, that it could well be if the perpetrators realise that they're likely to get prosecuted, they will reveal proof that the plane did hit the Pentagon. And set back our set back the progress of truth by decades. So it's a very important question, and I don't think David Ray Griffin has done it justice.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, actually, but he does say, he calls this your precautionary principle that you're using here, that when the evidence is as fuzzy as you say that it is here, we should stand back from it because of the dangers that you've just indicated. But he would say, well, if you're going to take a precautionary principle, then why not apply that right across the whole of the questions about 9/11? For example, we could say maybe the authorities are sitting on some explanation about how the Twin Towers came down, and they're withholding that explanation so that we can develop these theories, and then we can end up with egg on our face in future.
Well, there is no confusion about the Twin Towers and the Building 7. The scientific evidence that they came down with controlled demolition is absolutely irrefutable. It won't be us that gets egg on the face. It will be anybody who tries to say there was some other explanation. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. No, I just thought I'd put that point to you because that's something that I came across. And in fact, as I say, I do tend to agree with you on this point because, in fact, we had a similar kind of thing in a conversation with Tom Secker on this podcast, who was talking about the July 7, 2005 London bombings, where there was, in fact, released by the police an extremely poor image from a video showing the alleged bombers, and it was so poor that a lot of theories started to develop around this, saying that, oh no, this was a completely photoshopped image. And then later on, the police actually released the full video of which this frame was part, and of course it made people look silly. So I do know that that kind of thing does in fact go on, so maybe you're right, this could be a trap for us here.
Yeah, some people say the perpetrators wouldn't have really had the brains to work out that it would be a good idea to set up a trap. But I don't think that's necessary. They didn't have to work it out in advance. After the event, after the Pentagon had been hit and after people started coming up with funny ideas, it would have become apparent that confusion was an advantage to them. Then they could have made sure, and they did make sure, that all the information they released did not clear up the question. They left it confused. And I think that the fact that they leave it confused suggests to me that there is a trap and we should be wary of it.
Okay, I'd like to come back to this business of the debris, which you've talked about a little bit. Now, people do say, although it's true, that there are small fragments of debris scattered outside the Pentagon in the pictures that are available. Nevertheless, it's just not enough. It wouldn't add up to such a plane. And there are a few larger pieces, but they're at best ambiguous. They could have been planted in some way. What do you reckon to all this?
Well, it depends a great deal on which photographs you look at. In that particular paper that you referred to, What Hit the Pentagon, Misinformation, etc., there are some photographs there which show a great deal of debris on the lawn. There's also a lot of debris on the lawn in some of the videos that we see. But people talk about those, they don't bother pointing down at the ground and say, look at all the debris, they're trying to talk about something else. But it's there, if you keep your eyes open. And also, you have to remember that it was only the wingtips that would not find their way into the building. The wingtips and the tip of the tail, everything else would have gone in. So you don't expect to see much debris on the lawn.
But you say that there was a lot of debris actually inside the Pentagon as well. Is there photographic evidence for that?
Yes, there is. There's a photograph taken by a person standing to the left of the center line of the impact. You can clearly see the floor over this photographer's head. There is a floor which is virtually intact. There's a little bit of damage, a little bit of light streaming through, but the floor is virtually intact. Therefore, nearly all that debris had to be inserted between the ground floor, the ground, and this floor. It couldn't have fallen from above. And really, that all just lines up with all the other evidence. It means that the plane was flying almost horizontal, had to be flying almost horizontal in order to get in between the ground and the first floor. So, you know, all these things just add up to make a picture of a plane hitting the Pentagon and largely penetrating it. And quite a few of the witnesses use words which indicate that the plane was swallowed by the building or the plane went into the building. They say that it didn't just fall in a heap on the ground outside, but it went inside. Quite a few of them make a comment about that.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier an engine that people picked up, but I remember reading in an article, I believe it was on physics911.net, that although there was a part of an engine found, that it didn't match a Boeing 757 engine.
That's false. There's a very good website called Aerospace, I think, from memory, aerospace.com. They've looked at the debris and they've shown, they've got images of the internal structure of the engines. So you can see how, once you strip the outside off, what they look like. And that's what happened, of course. All the outside of the engine is just aluminium. It's going to get stripped off. You're going to be looking inside at the turbines and the housings of the turbines, and you can see clearly that the these inside components match the 757 engine.
And you mentioned testimonies as well, but I have to bring up the fact that David Ray Griffin, in his book 9/11, 10 Years Later, When State Crimes Against Democracy Succeed, has a list of witnesses who say things like, well, you couldn't see any bits of the airplane. It seemed to have been vaporized. There was nothing left. And this is by some people who are very close to the Pentagon itself. What do you make of those kinds of testimonies?
Yeah, well, I just look at those as scientific, with a scientific eye. If somebody says they don't see something, what does it prove? Right now, I don't see the wall behind me. But if I turn around and see it, I see it and I can report it. It's quite a different thing to say somebody sees something than that they say that they don't see something.
Well, I have to pick you up from a philosophical point of view and say that's significant, though, if you expect to see something and you don't see it. And that must be surely the case with these particular quotations.
Oh, well, that's a good point to make. If a person is expecting to see large pieces of an aeroplane lying on the grass, and they don't, they're liable to say, oh, there's no evidence of an aeroplane.
Mm.
But that's because they're expecting to see large pieces. But as we've already pointed out, it is impossible for the pieces that fall on the lawn to be large because the F4 Phantom experiment shows that anything that doesn't penetrate the wall will be turned into confetti. So if people were walking over this confetti, not seeing a large piece of an aeroplane, they're very likely to jump to the conclusion that there's no evidence for an aeroplane, but they're just wrong.
Okay, so I accept your position with outside of the Pentagon, their expectations are wrong, and therefore they're seeing the evidence in the wrong way. But what about with respect to inside the Pentagon? Because if I remember correctly, some of these quotations were coming from people who actually had access to the internal evidence, and that they would have expected to see something more significant inside, and apparently they didn't.
Well, how many days after the impact were they looking at it? The cleanup was very, very quick. All the stuff was carried outside, stacked in the carport and taken away.
Hmm. Okay, well, some of these things obviously we won't be able to clear up in this interview, but one thing that you bring out in great detail in one of your essays is the flight data recorder file, because that connects with the eyewitness reports. It corroborates perhaps the claims of many eyewitnesses that they saw this aircraft approach, that it would have been extremely loud, it would have been accelerating, it would have been spooling up, as you say, and this is borne out by the data. Could you tell us a little bit more about this this file and what it tells us?
Well, of course, the data file has been the subject of a great deal of confusion. Confusion seems to be the name of the game with the Pentagon.
Yeah, indeed.
When the file data was first released, there was information missing off the end of it. And a bloke by the name of John Farmer examined it and compared it with the radar data, and he concluded that at least 6 or 8 seconds of data was missing from it. But anyway, that didn't stop a lot of people from saying, oh, look, the plane is too high up. And I think the officials, you know, the National Transport Safety Bureau, made this a bit worse by fudging the data in their CSV file to make it the plane appear, to make the file appear to terminate within 1 second of the impact. Now, people said, oh, it's impossible, it's too high. But if the plane was 4 or 5 or 6 seconds back from the Pentagon, it could have easily descended in that time. So that's one of the things where the confusion has arisen. Warren Stutt proved that there was more data there, and he showed that it showed the plane descending and passing through the light poles and hitting the Pentagon exactly where the damage is. And there's another thing, there's another website which talks about the plane being too high and unable to pull up out of the dive and so on. They're working on the data from the altimeter. But the altimeter, I don't think the altimeters are properly calibrated to work at extremely high speeds at extremely low elevations. You know, the Pentagon's only about 13 feet off sea level. And planes don't routinely fly at hundreds of miles an hour within feet of the sea. So there's no need to calibrate an altimeter correctly for that purpose. And we were able to show, Warren Stutt and I were able to show, that as the plane descended, the discrepancy between the radio height and the altimeter increased until finally the altimeter was showing the plane flying over the top of the Pentagon, but the radio height was showing that it had hit the Pentagon. You can't get away from that. People have tried to say, oh, the plane, the last recording was 4 feet above the ground. That was 4 feet above the roof of the Pentagon. People raise all these ridiculous ideas, but it's perfectly straightforward, really, when you look at the data. The FDR, the flight data recorder, shows the plane doing exactly what the witnesses say. It descends steeply, it pulls up, it flies almost level, and it hits the Pentagon very close to the ground.
But you admit that this file has been tampered with in some way?
No.
It hasn't?
No. The first file released by the National Transport Safety Bureau had been tampered with. They'd put the data into an Excel file type of thing. And then once you got it like that, you can shift the data by as many seconds as you like. But when Warren Stutt used the Freedom of Information process to get hold of the original data file, which everybody thought terminated high up. He was able to decode the last 4 seconds of the last 4 frames and showed that it did lead to the impact with the Pentagon at the height observed. So, no, that data file, the original data file, had not been tampered with. It seems to exactly correspond with the physical damage and the witness testimony.
But is it not the case that there is, in fact, no identification for the plane?
No, that's false. Lots of people say that. If somebody says there should be an introduction to the file, a preamble in which the identification of the plane is recorded. But I've seen the file. The identification of the plane is recorded in one of the columns of data. It's repeated, you know, every 30 seconds or so. You can read what the plane identity is and where it comes from. So the identity is there. We can't say that it is AA-77 because we don't know the code. But somebody working for Boeing would know the code, and they'd be able to say, yes, that's AA-77, probably.
Well, that would be interesting for somebody to follow up on that, indeed. Find out.
It would be, yeah.
Yes.
It would. Yeah. And you would think that some of these people who are arguing the case, there must be some of them work for Boeing, you'd think some of them would be able to get hold of the data and give it to us, but nobody seems to be willing to do that. I think they like the argument.
Some say that the information was downloaded from the recorder before it was actually found, and that therefore that anomaly proves that there's something fishy going on here.
Well, of course, that's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people make mistakes. People write things down wrong. Somebody changes a 5 to a 7 or something like that. Who knows how the discrepancy came about? Human error.
Or I suppose it could even be something else thrown in to put people off the plot.
Yeah, well, human error, I mean, initially, when the impact time at the Pentagon was being broadcast, I think they put out about 6 different impact times before they actually finally settled on the one that proved to be correct. I think the proof is very, very well established about the exact impact time. The same bloke, John Farmer, who calculated that 4 or 5 or 6 seconds of data was missing from the file, went on to examine the radar data in great detail, and he was able to use a video of a plane hitting, I think it was the South Tower, which is time-stamped. So he knows exactly when the plane hit the tower. And he also has the radar information, which shows a certain time for that plane hitting the tower. Now, there's an error in the time. He calculates a correction factor for the radar data. He studied all the radars that were anywhere in the vicinity, and there are small discrepancies between the clocks of each of these radar systems. Remember, this happened a fairly long time ago. I think they'd probably all be standardised and using satellite time nowadays. But there were discrepancies. One of the radar stations actually had a discrepancy of 23 seconds.
Wow.
But he was able to show what the discrepancies of all the radar stations was, and he calculated by projecting from the last radar evidence, which occurred just outside the Sheraton Hotel. He projected forward to the impact distance, and calculated a time of impact which is within 3 seconds of the time you get from the flight data recorder. You know, there's just so much corroborating evidence here that there's just no way that this file isn't genuine. You can even work out the acceleration of the plane. As I think you mentioned earlier yourself, you heard people saying the plane had been given full throttle. Mm. So obviously accelerating and descending. It had to be accelerating if it was descending at full throttle. Well, if you go back to 3 or 4 radar readings, you can calculate the speed and the acceleration. And it corresponds with the acceleration from the flight data recorder. So, you know, everything all adds up. There's nothing ever comes out to make you doubt it.
And that leads me to an interesting question. Has anybody responded to your research in this area? Because as this is a scientific enterprise, then people can refute what you said. Has anybody tried to do that?
Warren Stutt has written a letter to the NTSB saying that there appears to be a defect in the software used to decode these files. He's pointed out what that defect is, hoping that it will be able to improve their technology and possibly be of benefit to the public. Anyway, he has not had a reply.
Sure. But has anybody within the 9/11 truth movement, looking at it from a scientific point of view, issued a rebuttal of your claims in this area?
No.
No, it still stands.
There's no scientific rebuttal of the Pentagon data any more than there is a plausible scientific rebuttal of the use of explosives at the Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm. So that really does behoove people, if they disagree with you, to show why they disagree with you on this. Now, there are some other things that I would like to ask you about your research, but before we get on to that, I think it would be quite a good idea to pause for a minute to give you the opportunity to explain the main reasons why you still nevertheless reject the official story of what happened at the Pentagon, that this was an Al-Qaeda attack, etc., etc., because, you know, I don't want us to give the impression that because you do actually argue that it was Flight 77, that therefore you think everything is satisfactory about the official explanation of what happened at the Pentagon. So could I ask you then, you know, to give us the main reasons why you still nevertheless find the official Pentagon story unbelievable?
Well, one of the most outstanding things is the fact that you can hardly expect these 19 hijackers with box cutters to have been able to plant the explosives in the towers. You know, how could anybody get the explosives into the towers without inside help? These buildings are highly secure. You need inside help to do that. Mm. And again, the question of how come all four airplanes managed to get into the air and fly a long way, particularly the Pentagon, for instance, because it flew an awful long way before it got back to hit the Pentagon. But, you know, the towers had been hit. There was ample evidence that there was a hijacking going on. Why wasn't there a fighter jet sent up to intercept it? Hmm. You know, how did those 19 hijackers manage to prevent the standard procedure? I believe there's roughly every week there's a plane goes off course or loses radio contact and they send a fighter jet up to escort it. It's just routine. So how come four planes were able to escape that on that day? Just not plausible. The more you look at it, the more it becomes clear that this is an inside job.
Mm-hmm. And what weight would you give the evidence of Norman Mineta's testimony to the 9/11 Commission, the Transportation Secretary at the time, who testified really that Cheney was in receipt of information that was very surprising?
Yes, I think that's a wonderful little video that people have. A lot of people have saved that video that has been deleted from the 9/11 Commission website. But Norman Mineta is saying that when he got there, Cheney was already in the bunker under the building. And while he was there, a young man came in and said to the vice president, "The plane is 50 miles out." And then later he came in and said the plane is 30 miles out. I might have these figures wrong, something like that. Mm. Norman Mineta then said, and when it got down to 10 miles out, the young man also said to the vice president, "Do the orders still stand?" And Cheney whipped his neck around and said, "Of course they still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?" And then a few minutes later, the plane hit the Pentagon. Now, when Mineta was being interviewed by Hamilton, Hamilton asked him which plane he was talking about. And he said, "The plane that came into the Pentagon." So there we know they had that plane on radar. They were following it on radar. They'd been following it at least for 50 miles. You know, they could have been doing something about it, but they didn't. And there was an order, you see. Cheney's words, "Do the orders still stand?" And he said, "Of course they still stand." So you're led to suspect, this is not hard evidence that I like, but it's very persuasive evidence nevertheless, that Cheney had established an order that these planes were not to be interfered with.
Well, I agree. That does seem to suggest that very much. But there are people who say, well, perhaps we're misinterpreting, that it could have been a different order. Perhaps it was an order to, in fact, intercept this. And the young man was coming in saying, "Well, look, you know, what's going on? It's still coming in. What's the explanation for this?" And then eventually saying, "Does that order still stand?" And of course, Cheney says, "Well, of course it still stands. You know, are we misinterpreting that conversation?"
Well, I think if you just look at it at face value, it doesn't make sense the other way around. I mean, if it was an order to shoot down the planes, why weren't they shot down? Why didn't a fighter jet take off early enough to do it? So I don't think it makes sense, really.
Indeed, I agree, actually. I mean, reflecting on that, I've often thought to myself, well, Cheney's reaction itself doesn't make sense. Would he just have said, "Well, of course it still stands"? Wouldn't he have said, "Yes, it still stands. What, you mean it's not being carried out?"
Yes.
You know, I would have expected that kind of reaction, really.
Yes, he could have said, "Yes, we really want that plane shot down, but I think it's too late," or something like that. But he didn't. No. He just said the order still stands. Yeah.
I agree. It does seem to fit with what we're suggesting here. Yeah. You say something about Hani Hanjour as well, that it's often said he was incapable of flying even a small aircraft, and so it was just completely implausible that he would have flown an aircraft like this. But you say something about, well, maybe he would have been able to set the autopilot. So do you feel that removes this piloting by Hani Hanjour from the questioning?
Well, I think there are two or three things you can say about this. First of all, as a scientist, am I convinced that Hani Hanjour couldn't have flown the plane? How do we know he wasn't faking it when he went up to fly a Cessna and did it so badly that they rejected him? Quite easy to fake doing something badly. It's quite possible. So that's one thing.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
There's another thing is, how do we know that Hani Hanjour was supposed to be the pilot? How do we know there wasn't somebody else on board that plane, somebody completely unknown, who was an experienced pilot who could have done it? And thirdly, in actual fact, the data in the flight data file indicates that the plane was partly flown by somebody who was very inexpert. When the plane descended, made its initial long descent, it was done on the autopilot and it's perfectly normal. But when it got down to some altitude, 7,000 feet or something, I forget, no, I never mind that altitude, it got down to a certain point and then it leveled off. Now, that's a pretty simple thing to do if you're an experienced pilot, but what happened at the moment the autopilot was turned off, the plane dropped 3,000 feet. 3,000 feet is a long way. And then it went up again, and then it went down again, and then it went up again. It went up and down three times, and finally, it seems they got the autopilot back on to altitude hold. And the plane flew at a very, very steady altitude for quite some distance after that, also on a suitable heading for some distance, very straight, flying very straight. But while it was doing that, something else was going on which didn't make sense. And that is that the throttle was being pushed in and pulled out, the plane was speeding up and slowing down. The autopilot hadn't been fully re-engaged. It had been partially re-engaged, and obviously pilots were trying to work out, since the throttle wasn't being controlled by the autopilot, they were trying to get the speed right, you know, playing around with it. So I think there's lots of evidence that part of this journey was actually carried out by an inexperienced pilot. Then the plane descended more and it did that circling descent towards the Pentagon, which everybody says, well, high speed, very skilled piloting. When you look at the flight data recorder, you find the plane's all over the place. It's banking left, it's banking right, it's going up and down, zigzagging all over the place, and finally gets down close to the Pentagon. It straightens out and it flies dead straight for the last 20, half a minute or so, straight at the Pentagon. And we notice also that these other undulations seem to stop. Now, maybe at that point, an inexperienced pilot had turned on the autopilot onto a program called, what do they call it? I don't know. But it's some kind of a process where the plane just follows its last setting. So you aim it in something and it will just go on hitting in that direction. You can set it on a slight decline, so it will descend and it will continue descending. And that's the way in which an unskilled pilot could perhaps have improved his technique and made it look more straight. Another alternative explanation is that at that moment, the authorities turned on a remote control and made the plane go perfectly into the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. Or there was a program built into the flight computer. So at that point, when the plane reached a certain point, that took over and guided the plane perfectly into the Pentagon. So there are so many different ways. The fact that Hani Hanjour apparently couldn't fly the plane, it doesn't mean to say there weren't hijackers on board. I think there were. But I think it's highly likely that the plane finally hit the Pentagon as a result of some external control, that the pilot didn't actually finish it off properly.
Mm-hmm. Well, fascinating again, indeed. Now, of course, by touching on the Hani Hanjour question here and perhaps saying that it's not quite such a significant point as is often claimed it to be, this is very much a sacred cow. I shall probably get a few emails about that one, but you make some very good points there. And of course, if indeed we do remove him from this equation as a problem for the story, that does not therefore mean that the whole story is as the official explanation would have it be. It just means that that part of the questioning is not quite as secure as perhaps we'd thought before. I want to ask you about the various objects that were en route. You've mentioned about the lighting poles. We also have some spools, some cable spools that were in the way, and things are said about these, such as, well, the lighting poles were being bent far too low to the ground, or indeed they were being bent in the wrong direction. The spools in front of the building should have been damaged, but they seem to be intact, which suggests, well, you know, that it couldn't have been that that aircraft hit the Pentagon. What do you respond to those?
Well, I've looked at the photographs of the poles, and they all look perfectly reasonable to have been hit by something soft at a very high speed. And these poles are not strong. They're meant to be weak, so cars can hit them and break them off. So I think that the appearance of the impact point on the poles is quite consistent with being hit by a soft aluminium wing of an aeroplane at very, very high speed. So the thing that actually bent the pole was really the pole's inertia. It wasn't its strength. The plane hit the pole high up and carried the top of the pole forwards at very, very high speed. And the strength of the pole was more or less irrelevant. Its inertia prevented it from moving forwards, and so it bent. That's why the bends, or you see bends in these poles. So, the poles look all right to me. And the question of the spools on the ground, now, there is a photograph, which is often shown, which suggests that the plane should have hit the spool. Luckily, there's another photograph taken from a different position. It's a little bit more to the right. And the photograph includes the fence, the nearby fence. There was people who were working in that area and they'd fenced it off. There was all sorts of work going on, that's why there was a power generator there. And one of the engines hit that fence and clearly did damage to it. Now, on this second photograph, you can see that there was a clear line from that damage point on the fence to pole 16 of the Pentagon. Perfectly clear. There's nothing in the way of that right-hand engine. It can go all the way from the fence to the pole without hitting anything. So that's part of the story. The engine couldn't have hit the poles. But also, we know the height of the plane, and we know its angle of bank, and we can calculate where the body of the plane would have been as it passed over the spools. And there's ample clearance. Even if the plane, I've done the sums, even if the plane was flying completely horizontal over the spools, the fuselage, the bottom of the fuselage, would have been sufficiently high to miss the spools by quite a bit. But it wasn't flying horizontal, it was actually descending slowly. So there's no possibility it could have hit the spools. So it's just a red herring.
And I guess you think also another red herring must be the question about the turbulence underneath the aircraft, where people say, well, there would have been so much turbulence that such a manoeuvre wouldn't have been possible in the last stages of the attack.
Well, it's not turbulence that they talk about, it's ground effect. Now, ground effect is something that all pilots experience when they're landing. As the plane comes into land, it has to fly very slowly, and the plane has to go nose up. As it slows down to land, it goes more and more nose up until finally the wheels touch the ground and then the nose settles. And probably, you know, you've watched aeroplanes landing. Now, it happens that ground effect is proportional to the angle of attack of the wings. Now, when the plane's flying very slowly, the wings are at quite an angle. You know, they might be 10, 20, 50, you know, 15 degrees from the horizontal, pointing upwards. So that the ground effect, which pilots experience, is quite strong at that point, and the plane could be settling at a certain angle that when you get close to the runway you can feel the lift coming from the ground. The thing is, though, that this plane wasn't travelling at landing speed, it was travelling at considerably faster than normal cruising speed. And then the faster it goes, the lower the angle of attack necessary to keep the plane in the air. In fact, finally, the plane's virtually flying dead flat, and the angle of attack is virtually cancelled right out. There's no ground effect at high speed. So simple as that, no ground effect at high speed. you can ask a lot of pilots about that, and most of them say that's wrong. They think the ground effect will be high at high speed, but that's just because it's not part of their experience. They never fly close to the ground at high speed.
The next question I have here, I'm not sure how it impacts. I suppose I'm asking you whether you think it is as simple as this aircraft hitting the Pentagon, or whether something else might have been involved. And I'm saying this because there are eyewitnesses who say that they smelt cordite, which gave them reason to believe that explosives have been actually planted in the Pentagon beforehand. And also people were reporting that there was death and damage as far in as the A and B rings of the Pentagon, yet as we know, the damage inside the Pentagon apparently only went as far as to puncture the wall of the C ring. So do you feel that there is evidence that there might have been more to this than just the aircraft hitting?
Yes, I think I've already mentioned the fact that I observed in one of those videos fragments flying over the roof of the Pentagon and landing in front of the camera. And also, in that video, there was a white flash before the red fireball, and explosives produce white flashes rather than red ones. So there's a couple of reasons for thinking the explosives might have been used. And the plane certainly did not pass the C-ring corridor. It didn't damage the wall of B-ring. So if there was damage inside B, it must have been done by something else, not the plane. Now, unfortunately, there's very little evidence. You know, there's no corroboration. There seems to be a lack of corroboration of that evidence that there was injuries in A and B rings. If we could get corroboration of that, I'd say, yeah, there's further proof of explosives. But it could well be that there have been corroborating witnesses, but the testimony has been suppressed. I just keep an open mind on that. I like to stick to the hard evidence, and I can't find really hard evidence that explosives were used, but I see indications, and I think it's highly appropriate to investigate the question of whether explosives were used. If you could prove it, that would be another way of saying 9/11 is an inside job. Now, the question of the smell of cordite, that's a bit puzzling to me, because cordite is a smokeless explosive used in rifle bullets. It's not a high explosive. We don't want to blow your rifle up. It's a moderate explosive. I think it would be highly unlikely to be used in a demolition inside a building, but it's possible. Maybe they chose to use cordite because it is smokeless. I don't know. Again, it's one of those vague things, and I prefer just to keep away from the vague things. You know, I say to myself, what we've really got to focus on is the collapse of the three buildings at the World Trade Center. Focus all the attention there, because the evidence is absolutely irrefutable. There's no doubt it's an inside job. No other explanation other than the use of explosives in a controlled demolition is feasible, and therefore it must be an inside job.
And so when we are talking to people who are not familiar with investigating or questioning this subject whatsoever, we should really deal, as David Ray Griffin said, with these primary issues and leave these secondary, not exactly squabbles, but these disagreements in the background, and have a very reasonable and measured conversation about them, but not share all of that with the outside world. You would agree with that?
I agree entirely. Now, the architects and engineers have been very successful in recent months. As you know, they focus their introduction to the subject with the public on Building 7.
Yes.
And they've done that very, very well. And they claim very, very high conversion rates when they talk with people about Building 7. And there's no need to talk about the Pentagon. And I think we should try and persuade people to avoid talking about the Pentagon as much as possible. Building 7 is, I believe, the most successful way to approach the public, because it's so clear. Whereas the towers, coming down a little bit slower than freefall, takes a little bit more mathematical calculations to prove your point. So I think, as a way of introducing the topic, by all means start with Building 7, but don't hesitate to go on to the Twin Towers and the use of explosives, because the proof, when you look at it, is absolutely convincing. When finally, the discovery of nanothermite is, it's irrefutable. There has to be a reason. There's no possible, plausible, innocent reason for nanothermite to be in the dust other than that it was there to cause explosive force or high temperature weakening of steel columns. So it's absolutely, there's no question that it's true that 9/11 was an inside job.
So can I ask you finally to, I mean, in a sense, you've given a message there to the 9/11 truth movement, which we've just discussed. But we have touched there on the issue of people who are still having difficulty engaging with this whole issue. So I'm wondering if I could ask you to give just a kind of general message to people, because there are people who listen to this podcast who, for the best of reasons, find it difficult to engage with this subject, and I can well understand that. But nevertheless, I obviously feel that this is an important issue, otherwise I wouldn't be giving so much time over to programming on it. So could you give a very brief message? Why do you feel this is so important to engage with?
So really what you're asking is, why is 9/11 as a whole important? And the answer is simply that if there are people, actually, before I get on to that, I should backtrack one step.
Okay.
Not only, if you're a scientist and an expert and an engineer and so on, not only is it very clear that you can prove that the buildings were brought down by explosives, once you look into it, it actually becomes obvious. Now, as soon as you accept that it's obvious to a scientist who really looks at it, you have NIST who say it wasn't explosives, therefore NIST is part of the cover-up. So now we know that NIST is actually complicit in the 9/11 event, just as a person who hides the identity of a murderer is complicit in the murder. So NIST is complicit in the destruction of the towers. Now, what does that tell us? We've got a very, very large portion of the administration of the United States of America complicit in 9/11, the murder of 3,000 Americans, and then the subsequent murder of millions of people in Afghanistan and Iraq, because those invasions were based on the events of 9/11. We see, therefore, that some part of the, I don't say the Congress as a whole, but some parts of very powerful people within the administration of the United States are motivated by the whole concept of the expansion of the USA empire into the Middle East. And they stop at nothing. They don't care how many people they kill as they attempt to take possession of the country there and get hold of the oil, get hold of the other minerals that are in those parts of the world. It's an extraordinary, the consequences of understanding about 9/11 are extraordinary. The consequences is you have to take an entirely new idea of the nature of the United States of America, who portrays itself as the policeman of the world, but in actual fact is the crook, the thug.
And maybe not just the United States of America. Niels Harrit was saying how he felt that this could be interpreted as a global coup in some way.
Oh, I certainly agree with that. When people ask me the question of who's behind it, I always say, that's not my role. I'm a scientist. I tell you what happened. It's your role as a journalist to investigate who is behind it. Logically, it has to be a global body. People, magicians behind the scenes carrying out all these plans for some foul reason. And I think the foul reason is a desire for global control, a totalitarian one government state ruling the world. And I think even the United Nations gets sucked into it somehow. The United Nations would like to see a one world government, I believe. And so they're to be suspected of being infiltrated by some of these people. We don't know who these people are, but there's no doubt at all that when people are trying to achieve goals with mass movements of one sort or another, they will infiltrate organisations and persuade people one way or another to carry out certain things. For instance, a person who doesn't like the peaceful protests in America might infiltrate a peaceful protest and start breaking windows so as to create disapproval of that peaceful protest. So I think on the mass scale, you can find that all sorts of organisations, possibly the Congress, possibly the Senate, who knows, possibly some of the governments in other parts of the world have been infiltrated, and who knows where all these people are. But, you know, I certainly go along with the idea that this is a global, a global power, not just the United States of America.
Yes, and I agree with you. I think that 9/11 is key to understanding many of the things that are going on in the world at the moment. And I also agree with you that we do seem to be heading in the direction of some kind of new world order, as it's called, and very much 9/11 could well be part of that trajectory. I do thank you ever so much, Dr. Legg, for coming on the program and sharing with us all this detailed information. It really has been fascinating to go through all this with you. How can people find out for themselves and read your articles and reach their own conclusions? You have one website. Could you direct people to that? Do you have any other websites as well?
I personally have only got one website, which is thescienceof911.com.au. But I'm also participating in Scientists for 9/11 Truth. That's a very important website, Scientists for 9/11 Truth. And there are many others, like Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There are many others. But on my own website, I've got a list of good sites to look at and a list of good papers. So anybody wanting to gently work their way into an examination of 9/11 could start with my website, because it's not very noisy. I just sort of set my story out clearly as I can, and I provide papers and links and peer-reviewed papers and things like that to back up all my statements.
Indeed. It is a very relaxed website to go to. I can back you up on that, absolutely. Well, Dr. Legg, thank you ever so much for joining us on the program. It's been great speaking to you. Thank you very much for agreeing.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. I think that the subject of the Pentagon is important, and the sooner we can get people to come to an agreement that it's foolish to debate the Pentagon, the better.
Well, great to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Okay, Julian. Well, all the best.
And to you. Bye-bye.